Welcome to the Amherst Reed interview about Dr. Aaron Carroll's 2011 best-selling book, Don't Cross Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way, and 75 Other Health Myths Debunked. We're here with Dr. Carroll to get to the root of some of the most common health myths of the ages. I'm Dr. Gary Cohan, Amherst class of 82. I'm a board-certified internal medicine physician in private practice here in Beverly Hills, California. And with me is the co-author of this really entertaining tome, Dr. Aaron Carroll. Hi, Aaron. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Before we dive into your eye-opening, myth-busting, and really funny book, actually, can you tell us a little bit about you, where you grew up, your time at Amherst, and your post-Amherst exploits?
Sure. I'm originally from Philadelphia, where I spent most of my time growing up. I was born in the city, and we moved into the suburbs. I went to an all-boys private school there for 12 years, which now looking back seems unbelievably long.
I'm actually from Philly as well. Where did you go?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I went to the Haverford School.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, I went to big public school, so excellent.
Well, where did you go?
I grew up in Northeast Philly, so I was sort of on the wrong side of the tracks.
Well, my mother is actually from Northeast Philly, and my grandparents lived there until much long after I left Philadelphia, so I know
Jewish
the area.
Jewish geography, I love this.
Great. So, and then I was in Amherst. I was a class in 94. I was a chemistry major. And then I went to medical school right after college at the University of Pennsylvania, and graduated from there in 1998, at which point I took my then-fiancé, and we moved all the way across the country to Seattle. I spent 5 years there, first as a pediatric resident, and then I stuck around for 2 more years to do a fellowship in the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program there, which is one of the perhaps the largest training program to become what is known as a health services researcher. So I actually do mostly research, mostly in pediatrics, but some of it more broadly. But as opposed to sort of being interested in molecules or even research at the patient level, I'm very interested in how we can change the healthcare system, how we can change the delivery of care, or the financing of care, or big, broad population level changes that we can make in order to improve the healthcare system. And so, after finishing my training in 2003, I took a job at Indiana University School of Medicine, where they were starting up a Children's Health Services Research Group, and I've been there ever since. And so now I'm an associate professor of pediatrics, and I'm also the vice chair for health policy and outcomes research. And I spend almost all my time doing research. Most of my funded research is in trying to use information technology and specifically clinical decision support in order to try to improve pediatric care. But I also do a fair amount of policy work as well. We do a lot of decision analysis and cost-effective analysis. I do some work in healthcare reform and also some work with malpractice data as well.
Wow. Well, couple things. So you and I sort of we kind of followed each other, except maybe missed by a decade. I went to Amherst undergrad and grew up in Philly. Went to Amherst undergrad and went to Penn to medical school as well.
Oh, really?
So I was class of 87. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I just recertified on my boards last Monday. So, very, very, very interesting. I'm an internist, and I actually did some homework, read your book, and I loved it. And I saw, obviously, your Stephen Colbert interview. So we're going to just go slightly off topic for a sec. And I agree with you that we need a single-payer system. Do you still kind of stand by that?
I believe that would be a much better system than we have right now. I've just, especially watching healthcare reform, just happen in the last few years, I've become a little bit more pessimistic at seeing anything like that pass in the near future, but there's just no reason to believe that such a system wouldn't work. Medicare functions incredibly well. People love it. In fact, even people who are sort of violently against health care reform seem to think that government should get out of Medicare. But single-payer systems across the world seem to do as well, if not better, than our system in terms of outcomes. They obviously cover everyone, and they often cost less. So I think it's an absolutely viable option for improving our healthcare system. Just unfortunately, it just doesn't seem to be very politically palatable at the moment.
Right, and it's interesting because guys like you and me are in the trenches. I'm an internist, and yeah, I'm in California, and I have a upper middle class clientele in Beverly Hills here. But I'm seeing what just general insurance companies are doing, and the whole system just needs a complete reboot. There's no fix to any of this. We just need to reboot it and have something new. And I agree with you that the political will just isn't there. So
yeah,
it's going to be an interesting decade.
And it's just sort of fascinating because, you know, when they do even surveys across countries, doctors here overwhelmingly believe the system needs to be completely rebuilt. Executives in healthcare overwhelmingly believe the system needs to be rebuilt. And patients overwhelmingly believe the system needs to be rebuilt, more so than almost any other country. And yet we have so much difficulty making even incremental changes to the system. There's I didn't make this saying up, but it pretty much sums it up, that, for instance, in France, they love their healthcare system and they change it all the time. And here we hate our healthcare system, but we barely ever do anything to change it at all. And so it's just an odd mix of knowing that something needs to be done, but the inability to do almost anything about it.
Right. Well, we won't go too far down the political thing because we're going to focus on your book tonight. So first of all, the book really resonated with me personally. Now, I'm a doc, but I'm a child of the 60s. I was born in 1960. So my two brothers and I, we were routinely scolded for all the things you got in your book. We sat too close to the TV. We read in the dark. We went out of the house with wet hair in Philly in the winter. We were told not to eat chocolate when we all appeared at the dinner table with teenage pimple explosions. So I'm pleased to report that we all got out of childhood alive and we're all healthy. But did any of my sweet late Jewish mother's motherly advice make any sense as far as
those
things go?
No, you know, and I have one of those too. It's just those moms I'm talking about. They just, almost none of the things that we're told have almost any evidence behind them. But what was even more shocking to us as we did the work for both the books is that how often there's really good science and really good evidence proving these things are totally wrong. I mean, 100% wrong. And yet, we continue to believe them. We continue to hear them from people we trust, be it our parents, be it teachers, be it even doctors. And it's just amazing how much of what we think sort of in keeping health and common sense and what we're told every day, let alone in actual practice of medicine, how much is not proven, and even more concerning is how much is totally wrong.
Well, let me ask you a two-pointed question, which is how much of this is just our inability to let go of, you know, sort of traditional thinking, and how much of this is myth perpetuated on the Internet?
Well, I think the word myth is a good one to figure out why these things stick around. You know, myths in general are stories that we tell ourselves that explain the world. And even if you go into ancient Greek myths or Roman myths, they were stories that people made up that explained why things were the way they were. And they made sense because the stories were very well crafted, and so people held on to them for a long time. Even after sort of science came around, it's still very hard to beat some of these. The myths that we tell each other now, some of the ones you just mentioned before, they make sense. There's a kernel of truth to them.
Mm-hmm.
They're good stories for explaining health or explaining why we see things in the world. And because they make sense and because we hear them from people we trust, we really do latch onto them and we hold on very tight. And they're very hard to break, even with good science. I think it's partially because a lot of them make sense and they're comforting because they explain things.
And I'm going to get to this a little later, but, you know, again, I'm in general internal medicine, so I'm people's primary care doc. And so all the herbs, vitamin supplement stuff, I get patients coming in every day telling me that they won't take Lipitor, where I have a zillion studies and their cholesterol, you know, is extremely high, but they
right.
won't take it because, you know, they think it's going to destroy their liver and because it's a man-made pill. But meanwhile, they'll swallow handfuls of Lord knows what's in it, you know, some organic compound that somebody tells them is an immune booster. So it's just none of that ever made sense to me. So why do you think humans are like that? Is it just a control thing where they think that if they do something that's on their own and not, you know, they're rebelling against modern medicine and they can take control on their own? Or what do you think it's all about?
Well, I think part of it is that people like the word natural, and that if they believe that something is quote-unquote natural, that somehow it's going to be safer or somehow it's not going to carry some negative overtones. And part of the faulty thinking there is that a lot of the drugs we use come from quote-unquote natural sources, be it we derive them from plants or we derive them from, you know, other things that occur regularly in nature. And so a lot of the quote-unquote natural things, I mean, the herbs, they have actual medicine in them. And so all you're getting when you take some, you know, herbals or natural things is just unregulated large amounts of drugs. And those can have the same kind of drug-drug interactions or negative consequences as the pharmaceuticals we buy in a pharmacy. So there's some problem there. I think it's also some people just do sort of buy into the idea that if something is, you know, told to be true and enough people have said it or it runs counter to industry or something like that, it just seems more palatable to some people. The problem there is that oftentimes when we do the same kind of studies, which shouldn't care whether it's Western medicine or Eastern medicine or anything else, a lot of the herbal remedies just don't work. And the studies we talk about in the book where they actually do study echinacea or vitamins or things that they just don't work, unfortunately. And yeah. So we can continue to believe it because we read it or see it or someone tells us that it's true, but the science just continually proves that they just don't often work.
Well, I kind of go into a soliloquy sometimes when people are, you know, get into the whole natural thing with me, and I said, look, I said, do you realize that aspirin was, you know, derived from the bark,
yeah,
of a willow tree? I said, now, when you have a headache, do I ask you to roll up or scrape off some willow bark and roll it into a joint, into a doobie, and smoke it? I said, no. I said, we purify it, and I can tell you to take, 325 milligrams. You know, when you get cancer and you need the chemotherapy drug Taxol, which comes from the bark of the Pacific yew tree.
That's my favorite example, but you took it, so there you go.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, well,
But you're exactly right. You're exactly right. These things are derived from nature. And
out here in California, you know, where we have, quote, medical marijuana, which I could speak about for a long time, and I won't bother, but, you know, I always tell patients, they said, well, don't you think it has some benefit? I said, yes, cannabinoids have benefits. We even have CB1 and CB2 cannabinoid receptors in our brain. However, I never ask my patients to smoke the crude combustion products of a dried plant to deliver a medication. I figure out the dose, you know, whatever, and then we do that. And they said, well, you're just buying into the industry, you know, you've just swallowed the industry Kool-Aid. I said, no, I haven't. I said, if there was somebody else that could make it and could purify it, I said, I'm just trying to basically do what the Hippocratic Oath says, do no harm. I'm trying to protect you.
Well, in the same way we often give babies in the neonatal intensive care unit caffeine to stimulate breathing, but we don't feed them Coke. You know, we actually use it as a drug. You know, it comes in, you know, injectable form where we can titrate it to exact amounts. We know exactly how much of the drug you're getting. We don't give them sort of just willy-nilly, you know, try to get it out of a Coke can or try to get it out of coffee. It's, you know, if it's an actual substance or an actual molecule with some sort of pharmaceutical property, it's better to know that the process by which it is being measured is exact and that it's gone through safety testing and that you're assured that dose after dose after dose, it's going to be the exact same thing.
Well, let's get back to your motivation for writing the book. To get back, this was not, to get back at some primal thing to get back at our Jewish mothers and all of their motherly advice. But what was your motivation for writing, another book, a book like this? And what would you like the reader of the book, both patients and especially doctors like us, to come away with? In other words, how should patients approach it? And then how might this help docs explain things to patients?
Well, this all started, God, it was years ago now, but I was driving, in fact, it was almost exactly this time of year because I was driving home from work and I was listening on the radio and there was a doctor pontificating about how Halloween was coming up and that parents needed to be really careful about checking their kids' candy because they had to make sure that strangers weren't poisoning it and that this was a real danger and that, you know, they were even talking about the fact that some hospitals were offering free X-ray services for candy to make sure that nothing had been put in it. And I was enraged because working in, you know, sort of healthcare form and things like that, I have so much trouble getting my patients' X-rays that the thought that they were going to be giving them away for candy was just insanity. And I thought, I got to be honest, I've been treating kids for years. I know tons of pediatricians. I've worked in many hospitals, and I've never, ever seen this actually happen. And so I went and looked it up, and it turns out that there's a guy named Joel Best. I think he works out of Johns Hopkins. And he basically dedicated his life to disproving this myth. He would travel to cities and search through police records and newspapers over 40 years in all the sort of major metropolitan areas, and he could find not a single confirmed case ever of a child being poisoned by a stranger with Halloween candy.
Boy, do I hope.
And there have been a number of big cases that you've heard about, but every single one of them has been a family member that has poisoned their own child, or a child, one was a child getting the uncle's heroin stash and overdosed, so they sprinkled it on the candy to try to hide. They're all, the danger's within. It's in the house, in the family. There's never, ever, ever been a confirmed case of a stranger poisoning a child's Halloween candy. And yet here it is on the news, and this is what they're talking about. And I was just like, this is crazy. You know, this is, we've bought into this and we've medicalized it. Yep. We've made it something that we're willing to now spend resources and dollars on in the healthcare system, which we don't have. And that seemed crazy. And I went and spoke to my co-author, who was my fellow at the time, and I mentioned this, and she brought up a few other myths, and ones that I actually believe were true. And I looked at her and said, like, this is, you know, we got to do something with this. And we wrote a poster and submitted it to our big pediatric research meeting. And, you know, I've been doing this for years. The poster was mobbed. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. And I said, okay, we've got something here. Let's submit it as a paper. And so we sent it into the British Medical Journal, which is a reasonably high-profile journal.
Yeah, sure.
And they took it and accepted it faster than any other paper I've ever written. It was just sort of crazy. And so they took it, and our first paper was published in their Christmas journal. I think it was now in, I can't even remember, it was in probably 2007 or 2008.
Right.
And it was called Medical Myths Even Doctors Believe, and it was a list of myths that we thought were good for that. And, you know, that process had gone so well, I turned to Rachel and said, we should write a book. And so that's what we did, and it all seemed to work out very well. We even submitted another paper to the British Medical Journal the next year for the same issue, and they wound up making the entire issue's theme on myths. And printed another one, which we wrote based on holiday myths, and then we did the first book and we did the second book. But it was started in this idea that, you know, doctors are human beings, and even we fall prey to, you know, trying to use these stories or these myths or these things that we've been told to explain why the world is the way it is, even in healthcare. And we sometimes are so obsessed with the new and what's the latest treatment and what's the latest thing that's come out that we never take the time to examine our previously held beliefs or the things that we were just told that we just assume were true. And when we did these kind of searches and looking in the medical literature, we were surprised, first of all, how often there was no evidence to support these things we were telling patients, but even more concerning was sometimes there were amazingly well done randomized controlled trials, sometimes published in like the New England Journal of Medicine, proving these things were totally wrong, and yet still we continue to believe them and tell people that they were true.
That nobody essentially picked up on.
They
never got big press.
Physicians, that this is hopefully, you know, explaining that, you know what, you need to actually think about why this stuff is so. You can't just accept that because you were told it was so that it's true. That you really need to question the evidence, just like we do with any new drug, just with any new procedure. And for patients, we often say, or just the general public, you need to question why. You know, if your doctor tells you to do something, or even anyone tells you to do something, ask why. And if they don't have a good answer, they should go look it up, because sometimes we tell patients to do things because we know there's incredibly good scientific evidence or research to tell them to do it. And if that's the case, we should be pretty strong about this is what you should do. But if we're just offering an opinion, or if there's no evidence behind what we're saying, well, then there's a lot of room for negotiation there. And there's a lot of room for interpretation, and patients should be empowered to wonder, why do I have to do this, or what are the risks and what are the benefits, because often there are both. And, you know, do I really need to do that? And you know, how much evidence is there behind this? I often encourage my patients to ask why, and I think it's a good thing for all people to do.
Yeah, I take care of a pretty bright crowd, and in my specialty of internal medicine, the motto of the last several decades has been to do just what you, exactly what you just said, Aaron. Question everything that's traditionally been done in medicine but might not have data to back it up, but to only practice what scientific study proves to work, and they call that evidence-based medicine. And that sounds like what you're trying to do with a lot of the folklore that you debunk in your book. So, you know, some of this stuff must have been kind of obscure. I mean, you said some was in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is not exactly obscure, but how exactly did you get to the root of some of the more widely held beliefs and medical myths? I mean, did you have to do a lot of digging?
We did a lot of digging. So first we would go to the medical literature. So we did a lot of searches on PubMed or from the National Library of Medicine, or we would do searches of Ovid, or we would even try sometimes to get into the European literature to see if there were studies to tell, you know, what kind of evidence is behind these. There's a surprisingly large amount. I mean, you know, the books are somewhat lighthearted, but the reference section is very long in both of them because we, you know, are very clear in sort of detailing the studies within, but also giving people the references. So, you know, we're trying to say we're not just offering you one more opinion or trying to, you know, tell you another story. This is why and this is where we got it from, and feel free to go look it up. If we couldn't find evidence in the medical literature, we would do more broad internet searches, or we would actually go to books. And in those cases, then we were clear, you know, about how much evidence is behind it. But, you know, the thing about evidence-based medicine, and I'm totally in favor of it, is that, you know, when there's no evidence, you really just sort of have to weigh the risks and the benefits, and, you know, or the potential risks, the potential harms, and also the potential good. Because some of these things are very benign. And, you know, if you want to believe it, go right ahead. And, you know, go ahead. You know, a lot of them, if you want to use honey for this, fine. It's not going to hurt you. That's perfectly fine. But some of these things, you know, carry potential harms. They're not fun, or they can interfere with breastfeeding, or, you know, you're just making life less enjoyable for no good reason. And in those cases, you should weigh those potential harms against what you're being told to do.
You bring something up that's really near and dear to my heart. I actually, not just an internist, but I'm actually an HIV specialist. And I started at the very beginning of the epidemic before we even had identified the virus. And we finally, you know, it was kind of a medical, I hate to use the word, but it was true, a medical holocaust for the first 15 years. Everybody died. And in the mid-90s, we finally get these protease inhibitors and cocktail drugs. Well, some of my patients, unbeknownst to me, were, and we didn't even know the interaction, were taking certain supplements. And that was very big in the community at the time. And they were taking one especially for depression called St. John's wort. Yep. And it was a supplement that lowered the levels of a specific protease inhibitor. Its name was Crixivan, to the point where they failed their medicines and they died. And, you know, I kind of came away after that because I kind of sort of had a very laissez-faire shoulder shrug to the whole vitamin thing. I didn't buy into it, but I really didn't do much about it until that happened, and I realized that we could be doing, or patients could be inadvertently doing themselves some serious harm. So I actually sort of tell my patients, look, I said, I want you on less rather than more, and I want us to use things that work and that prove that work rather than don't have science. And very frankly, I said, let me just give you my overall philosophy, which is I believe in the last several million years of human evolution more than I believe in the last 50 years of popping pills.
Yep.
And so I said, I don't really trust very much of this stuff till we get proof, so I'd rather you take less. So if you're going to ask my opinion, you know, unless we've proven that, you know, vitamin D is a good thing to take, which we have proven, I kind of want you to be careful about what you're doing.
And I can't agree with that, you know, more. I think that, you know, I've always sort of practiced as a minimalist. This has even made me more so, where I just don't want to do anything unless, you know, you have to. Because part of my job is to sort of weigh, you know, the risks and the benefits. And when we talk about cost-effective analysis, and we talk about decision analysis, and we talk about, even when I do my research in clinical decision support, you know, anytime I tell a doctor to do something, that means they're not going to be able to do something else. And so everything has some kind of cost. And again, I'm betraying my, you know, healthcare policy roots here, but cost is a cost. And so when people are spending a lot of money on megavitamins or you know, on some herbal therapy, those things are often very expensive. And if there's no proof and they can actually do bodily harm and they cost a lot of money, then I'm not really for them. And so I have taken more of a hand, I think, like you have, and just sort of saying, I don't think this is a good idea. In the end, people are free to do what they like, and they often do. I have a lot of patients that will often use cough and cold medicines in small children, even though I strongly tell them I don't think it's such a good idea. And there's a lot of even, you know, prescription drugs that we know don't work, that they're really good, you know, studies showing us they don't work, but yet they're still on the market and people still use them, and they have costs, they have harmful side effects, and it's probably not a good idea. But it's very hard to get people to change their behavior, even doctors. There are a lot of doctors that still believe in a lot of this stuff.
Absolutely. And you know, my patients will routinely Google themselves into a lather. They'll come to see me after already having misdiagnosed themselves with terminal cancer, or they think they should be taking some exotic new nutritional supplement promoted by a celebrity, and one of the ones that I am just beyond furious. You talked in the, you know, early part of the interview about just being so mad about the Halloween candy myth. Suzanne Summers, I mean, if, you know, anybody can shoot me down if they want to, but this woman has done more harm than, you know, many of the celebrities and, you know, in dispensing medical advice. What do you, you know, think of the blizzard of information that's out there in cyberspace? What do you think it's doing to, you know, our patients' health? What do you think, because they may not be asking us. They may be actually just Googling it themselves and driving themselves crazy.
That's fine. I mean, even before I asked that, I actually had to read her latest book as a favor to a journalist friend who was supposed to write a review about it so I could talk about it. And there were multiple times I literally threw the book against the wall. That was a very difficult book to get through. But, you know, there's a lot of danger. For me, sort of my anger gets directed at Jenny McCarthy most often, because sort of the crusade on vaccines against autism, and it was actually, I think it's the last myth we did in the first book, because back then still people would get very angry about it, and they still do, but I think, and, you know, the research has been so discredited at this point, where I think even within the last year they proved to some extent it was a fraud, that it doesn't evoke that kind of anger. But, you know, celebrities or people you trust, this is, again, the same thing. It's like if they tell a good story, and with Jenny McCarthy, there was a story that she told about how her child was totally normal, and then he had a seizure, and he developed autism. And of course, those of us who treat children know that is not the typical way you develop autism. It's not that you have a huge, long seizure, and then all of a sudden you have autism. That's a completely different process. He might have something else. We know the science often behind how they do the vaccine studies, but the story and the celebrity carry far more weight. And because of the way the world and the media works, you know, she gets ratings, and so she gets on TV shows, and she gets, you know, to make appearances, and she makes impassioned pleas with phenomenal anecdotes and stories which resonate, and these are incredibly hard to beat with boring data and evidence.
Well,
and so,
I mean, even in my adults, I mean, the collateral damage, the spillover effect, I mean, I'm trying to give my adults, you know, shingles vaccines. I'm trying to give my at-risk, you know, younger adults the Gardasil vaccine against human papillomavirus. I'm trying, you know, the first virus, the first vaccine proven to prevent a cancer, for God's sake. You know, and just simple, it's flu season now. We're recording this in October of 2011. And just, you know, giving people flu shots and having to spend the time to explain that this is not going to hurt you, and is this thimerosal or mercury-free, et cetera, et cetera, is just, you know, crazy. I'm telling people, I said, well, the ultimate vaccine is getting the disease, but I don't think you want to do that.
No. And vaccines have always been hard because we're often treating things which are rare. I mean, you know, most doctors have never seen polio. And so the idea that we should continue to give a vaccine against it is hard for people to swallow. It's also hard because people often will get the attitude of, well, you know, if everybody else gets the shot, then I don't need to, and therefore I don't have to carry the harm. But we forget that oftentimes we're not vaccinating ourselves to protect ourselves. We vaccinate ourselves to protect everybody else.
Well, that's what's happening right now with the measles epidemic.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm having to give, you know, the MMR, measles, mumps, rubella boosters to people who are traveling. But, you know, you read that we've had the largest number of measles cases, and it's from these people who have not vaccinated their kids, figuring, well, everybody else gets vaccinated, so it's not my, not, you know, I'm not going to give my kid the vaccine. I find that just so maddeningly irresponsible.
Yeah, and we forget sometimes that, like, we often, now we give the flu shot very broadly, but back at the beginning, we were giving the flu shot to parents and to kids, not just to protect them, but to protect the babies that might be at home, who can't get the shot and yet don't have the immune system, or to protect, you know, the elderly that they come in contact with, who have, you know, much more susceptible immune system. So we're protecting others, not just ourselves, but it all gets lost in this, you know, mythical story of, you know, this is some harm or some conspiracy perpetrated by companies, when, you know, the vast majority of companies don't want to produce vaccines anyway because they're not real big, for most of them, are not real big money makers. And yet the stories are powerful. They are almost myths, and they take root, and, you know, and when they're proven wrong, they just shift. So when the MMR is constantly being proven wrong, all of a sudden it's, well, any vaccine can give you autism, or it's the mercury, or it's the number of vaccines that we're giving, or it's something else. And instead of just starting from sort of the scientific method of, wait, what was the original thing we were trying to prove, and how do we get here? It's just a story which continually evolves, and it's incredibly hard to beat a good story.
Yep. Well, let's go to a couple of specifics, you know, just to make this kind of fun. I mean, and this has been fascinating, you know, so far, because I think we've just touched on so many broad topics that, you know, we could talk for a really long time, but
sure.
I figured we don't have that much time. But at Amherst, I was on the crew team, and our coach, Hank Dunbar, required that we stretch for 15 minutes before a rowing workout. So, any benefit to stretching?
No, and you know, this is one of the ones that blew me away, because, and there are a number of these that are just, I was so sure they were correct.
Yeah.
That when you find out they're not, it changes your whole outlook. So this is, again, these are provable, testable concepts, and so they've done studies using athletes or soldiers where they will randomize them to do you stretch, you don't stretch, and they will actually then go and look and see, does it prevent injury? Because injuries will occur with and without stretching. The big question is there less injury if you do stretch? And it turns out there's not. That it doesn't really do any good at all. In fact, that there's some evidence, although it's not huge, to support the fact that performance may go down slightly with the stretching. And so it's one of those things where you just know it's true. You've been told 1,000 times it's true. It makes intuitive sense. But when they actually go and look at it, it doesn't provide anything in terms of benefit at all.
Fascinating. Now, here's one that my patients completely believe, and I have to kind of, you know, give them a whole story about. My patients typically believe that wounds really heal better when they're left in the open air, and hydrogen peroxide's best way to sterilize a cut or a scrape. What's the real story?
Yeah, those are two more that I totally believe were true. So the hydrogen peroxide, I'll discuss that one first. So everybody even knows why it seems so good, because you pour it on the wound and you see the bubbling and you're like, okay, that's phenomenal. That's killing the bacteria. But it turns out that the bubbling is the hydrogen peroxide killing you.
Yes.
It's attacking your own cells. It doesn't differentiate between bad stuff and good stuff. It's just incredibly caustic. And so they've done phenomenally good studies where they were both on pigs and humans. They will do a number of cuts, either like a number on the pig or a number on the human, and then they will treat them differently. Like they'll put hydrogen peroxide in one, or they'll do nothing to another, or they'll put, you know, Neosporin or something in a third, or they'll do something. And so they can see what happens, and it turns out that hydrogen peroxide actually slows the wound healing. It makes it worse because it's killing off the cells you need in order to heal that wound. It does damage. There was even an anecdotal case report in 2010 of a woman who had hydrogen peroxide put in a wound post-op, and I think she developed an air embolus and died. And that's not going to happen commonly. But it, again, is a reminder that this is not benign. Like, that hydrogen peroxide is actually doing you damage, and it actually makes things worse.
Let's use, you know, plain old, good old hydrogen peroxide as sort of our whipping boy here. I mean, then why is there not a warning label on hydrogen, those little brown bottles of hydrogen peroxide saying, don't put this on a wound? Why do they leave these alone?
I have no idea. This is one where I'm baffled, because it actually seems to make things worse, and yet it is. But on the other hand, it will probably kill the bacteria, because, again, it's like pouring acid on them. It'll kill everything. It's just not good. Like, it's not going to make the wound heal faster. In fact, it makes it heal slower. I agree with you. I don't understand why there's not a strong, or why do we not know as doctors, why do we not all know this? I mean, it just seems the kind of thing like that would be important to know.
But that's how it's marketed. It is sold in Walgreens and CVS and whatever your local pharmacy in the Band-Aid and the, you know, and the antibiotic ointment section right there. So, I mean, how could you not associate that just by the pure marketing of it all?
Yep, I completely agree. But in the same line, you mentioned the other one, which is, you know, uncovering a wound to heal at night. And many times I've told my kids, take the Band-Aid off, let it air out, let it dry up, that's going to help. It turns out that that's, again, 100% the wrong thing to do, in that keeping a wound moist and covered is by far the best way to make it heal. Again, they've done studies, same kind of studies as before, lots of different cuts, different ways of doing it. It turns out that letting a wound dry out is almost the worst thing that you can do, because the skin is coming in from the sides to heal. It doesn't come up from below. It comes in from the sides, and if you let it dry out, then what happens is that you get a worse scar, I mean, you get a worse scab, excuse me, or you get the edges drying out and some of that skin actually starts to die, so the cells can't grow inward. And so if you let it dry out, it takes longer to heal, there's more of a risk of infection, and because of the increased scabbing, it actually will likely leave a worse scar. So keeping it covered and moist is by far the best thing you can do. You don't ever really want to take it off and air it out.
Don't new skin cells, new epithelial cells, like to have a surface to climb along, like the, you know, like the little pad of a Band-Aid?
That might work, too. To be honest, I'm not, you know, the studies that we looked at were mostly clinical, so they weren't investigating the actual mechanism by which all of this occurs so much as what happened. But that could be exactly correct as well, that keeping it covered and moist and with something there might actually promote the movement of the epithelial cells as well. But for whatever reason, it's unequivocally true that keeping it covered and keeping it moist does far better for speed, for infection, and for the cosmetic, you know, properties of how it's going to heal than opening it up and airing it out.
Okay, so I've got a dentist, great guy, and he told me a long time ago, you got to get rid of your metal amalgam fillings. I've had them for over 40 years, God bless his soul. Dr. Phil Fink put them in, you know, in the 1960s and 70s. They're fine, but am I eventually going to get mercury poisoning if I leave them in?
No, and this is another one where it's like, because it's mercury, and mercury in some forms is not good for you. Let's get that clear. You know, you don't want to go break open thermometers and start drinking the mercury. But the mercury that's actually in the fillings is not the same mercury. It's not the mercury that you're going to inhale. It's not the mercury that's going to cause you significant damage. Moreover, there's just not that much leakage. And we've been using these things for a long time. They're very, 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 very safe. And yet, because it's the same mercury, and we hear about mercury in fish, and we hear about mercury in vaccines, people start to panic. I'm going to get all these things ripped out and put in the new non-mercury fillings. My dentist, I'll have a discussion with him, and he'll often say to me, well, these new fillings last longer. And so I'll look at him and say, like, well, why don't we just wait till the other ones fall out and then put the new ones in? And he sort of stares at me as if I'm crazy, because that's logical. But they're very much conditioned, and there's an economic incentive. If they take out your old fillings and they put in the new fillings, there's some money to be made. And I'm not saying that they're, you know, consciously thinking how much can I bilk out of you, but economic incentives work. There's a reason that 10-cent coupons work. Subtle, tiny economic incentives drive how we do things. And there's a big business in getting those mercury fillings out and putting the new fillings in, but there's just not much health risk at all. Nobody's ever been able to prove anything from having those mercury fillings in your mouth.
Great. Well, I've left mine in, so I feel empowered.
I've left my one in as well.
Can you catch a cold from going outside with a wet head or from flying in an airplane?
Okay, the second one is interesting, but let's do the cold one first. So this is just bread and butter for mothers and grandmothers and fathers and everyone else. But, you know, if you go out with hair, if you go out in the cold, you're gonna get sick. And first of all, no. We know what makes you sick. It's germs, most often viruses. And we know that's what makes you sick. It's not the fact that you were chilled. It's the fact that you got a virus. Now, some viruses may be more common in cold weather. And so if something is more common to be caught, like the flu in the winter, you're going to get it more often in the winter. But it's not because you were cold. And don't take my word for it again. I don't know who volunteers for these kinds of studies, but people do. They did amazingly good studies where they would take some people and keep them in chilled cold water, and some people they wouldn't, and then they would inject live viruses in their nose, and they measured the rates at which people became infected. And being wet and being cold had no effect whatsoever on the chance that you would be infected by a virus if you were exposed to it. The temperature and being wet have nothing to do with it. There's an interesting theory as to why people often get some illnesses more in the winter. It's because partially we are so afraid of this kind of myth that we stay inside more in the winter. Therefore, we stay around other people more in the winter. And because we're more often exposed to other people, many of whom are sick, we pass along illness a little more often in the winter. And it has nothing to do with going out being wet or going out and being cold. It's often the fear of that and the story which is perpetuating this whole idea that people are more often likely to get sick in the winter.
So do we need to do like a complete mother re-education program?
I'm trying. There's only so much I can do. Moreover, I just can't. There's some of these I can't win. And, you know, there's one or two myths which, you know, if I can just get rid of these one or two, I will die happy. And I'm yet becoming convinced it's never, ever going to happen. And partially it's mothers, partially it's grandmothers, and partially it's just human beings. But yeah. It's almost impossible sometimes to convince people that these things aren't true. They make sense. You know, we just see it. We know we're going to get sick in the winter. We know that being cold is going to give us a cold. And so it doesn't matter how much evidence that I can throw at you, it's very hard to break that belief.
Now, I know the answer to the airplane question, but all right, so tell me, what is it about airplanes that people think they're getting sick from?
Well, again, it's the close quarters, and it's the close quarters, and secondly, it's the panic that people believe that there's only a limited amount of air, and, you know, we're going to fill it with viruses, and we're going to fill it with bacteria the longer people stay there, and therefore it's going to be problematic. But it turns out air is very well circulated in planes, constantly. Mm-hmm. And they have very good filters. So often the planes are as well, if not better, filtered than your house may be or even like your office may be. And so certainly, you know, common sense prevails. You don't want to be sitting next to someone who's sneezing directly into your mouth. But, you know, you're no more likely to get sick because you're on a plane with other people than you are to be in an office building with other people or in a school with other people or anything else. The air in planes is very well circulated and very well filtered.
Now, one of the things I did hear, so here's in defense of something there, is that the air in airplanes, yes, it's filtered, it's recirculated, not good air, but it's very dry, tends to dry out mucous membranes, and maybe that's where viruses can attach. Any thoughts about that?
Well, there is some truth to the idea that the air is drier, but that's overcomable. You know, certainly drink, or you know, you can also suck on a candy or chew some gum, or do any other thing to try to keep yourself more hydrated. So, in that respect, it is possible that you could catch. But again, we're talking incremental differences. I mean, pretty small, and so the likelihood that you're going to get sick from being on a plane maybe slightly more, but it can easily be balanced out, and it probably is balanced out by the fact that the air is actually being filtered with filters to clean it. And in your house, that's not nearly as likely to be true. It's probably not as true in a school. And in many office buildings, it's probably not as true there either. Certainly not in a car, probably not in a train or in a subway. And so, you know, these are risks we take as human beings just by living and being social and choosing to go and do things. And we should always weigh the potential benefits and, you know, versus the harms. But more often than not, the benefits of air travel are going to far outweigh the incremental, often infinitesimal, risk of getting actually sick more than you would have otherwise.
Yeah, this summer, actually, I took a flight. I'm chief medical officer for an international stem cell company. So we do a lot of international work. So I go to Asia a fair bit, and there's a load of people on every one of these flights to Asia. A lot of, you know, people, you know, not usually the Westerners, it may be more the Asians, but that are wearing, you know, surgical masks,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they think that may, you know, may help them in some way. And it's not because they're sick and they're trying not to sneeze on somebody.
Right. I see a lot of that, too. We were just in Washington, D.C. last week, and I saw a lot of people. Ironically enough, I think it is an Asian thing to do. Maybe it came out of SARS or something else. But there is a lot of concern about, you know, getting sick and how we can prevent it. My issue is often that we seem to fixate on these things which are unproven and often don't work at all while ignoring things which are huge and that everybody knows is more likely to make you unhealthy, and yet we do this. Look, for instance, eating badly and obesity. I mean, everybody knows that that's not a good idea, yet obesity is rampant. Smoking absolutely leads to significant risks of disease. Many people smoke. Drinking, same kind of thing. And yet, you know, people on the other hand will be obsessed with, you know, natural things or mega vitamins or you know, masks or things, all of these things which we can use to prevent illness that don't necessarily work, that are completely unproven, and yet we ignore things every day which are massively proven and are common sense, but they're difficult or they're not fun. And so we don't want to do those things.
So let's go for the last couple quickies. Sit-ups, do they help flatten a flabby belly?
No, and you know, it's funny because it's like, you know, everybody wants that six-pack and everybody wants a really strong abdomen. And the truth of the matter is that unless you have an incredibly low body fat, you're never going to see that six-pack. And that the fat that's covering your belly is just going to prevent you from seeing the muscles, no matter how strong they are. And you can't target fat loss. Doing sit-ups will not make the fat on your belly go away. Fat is going to be lost globally, if at all, and that's only through significant weight loss and perhaps exercise. But, you know, targeting one area of the body with exercise will not reduce fat in that area. And so if you have a high enough body fat that you're not going to see your abdominal muscles, it doesn't matter how many sit-ups you do, it'll make no difference whatsoever.
Now, so we'll stay with exercise for a second, and then we'll move on to the elephant in the middle of the room, which is vitamins. But protein shakes. You hear bodybuilders doing protein shakes that build muscle after workout. I mean, I know these guys are doing a lot of anabolic steroids, but how do these guys get this big, you know, and they're all, you know, slugging down these, you know, massive, you know, quantities of protein shakes? Is it just the calories, or, you know, what's the deal with protein?
Well, it is the calories, and it's also how much you work out. There's these two guys at the gym I go to. I work out with a friend a couple days a week, and we go to the gym. And no matter what time we get there, if we get there at 6:30, if we get there at 7:30, if we get there at 6, these guys are there. They're working out for hours. And if you work out for hours, you're going to see results.
Right.
You know, but most of us are not going to do that. Your body needs protein in order to build muscle because, of course, muscles are made out of protein, but you don't need massive doses of it. In fact, if you take too much of it, your body's just going to convert it into other things, or it's going to excrete it. And in fact, if you take too much protein, it can actually be slightly harmful to your kidneys,
right,
which are processing tons of stuff that they just normally don't see and don't know what to do with. But there is probably some truth to increasing your calories and, you know, increasing your protein a bit will put you in a more anabolic state in order to build. But you'll build everything. You'll build fat, you'll build muscle, you'll build everything. And the more you work out, the more results that you will see. But just taking massive doses of protein will make no difference. Your body is not going to suddenly just decide to convert that into muscle. It just sees it as fuel, and it's going to use it as fuel. And too much fuel without burning it off is going to result in often gaining weight and putting on fat as well.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, across from where we went to medical school, the Wistar Institute, I remember that they were one of the very first, you know, places that started to study longevity. And they really showed that one of the things that's always been proven and that really doesn't get much press is that extremely low-calorie diets are associated possibly with maybe less free radical damage to DNA and people live longer. What do you think about that?
There is a fair amount of evidence to prove that's true. Convince anyone in the United States to try to follow that diet, however. You know, there's no way. We have a bad enough time trying to convince people to follow moderate calorie diets, let alone low calorie diets. And again, it's one of those things where I can't prove causality, but we have the lowest life expectancy of any industrialized nation in the world. And I often like to blame that on the healthcare system as well as other things, but we also have the highest caloric diet, you know, pretty much of any nation in the world. And perhaps there's some link there as well, but there is a reasonable, you know, amount of evidence, at least the starting of the theory, that exactly what you just said, that extremely low-calorie diets are probably good for increasing life expectancy. But, you know, I can't get people to change their diets for even short-term benefit, let alone, you know, living a few years longer back in their 70s.
Well, let's kind of, you know, kind of close this up, because I know we've been going for a little while here. you know, with my very fave, herbs and vitamins, particularly like popular things. So vitamin C for colds, vitamin E to prevent prostate cancer, echinacea, glucosamine chondroitin, and things like Airborne created by a school teacher. Do they really ward off colds, help arthritic joints, prevent cancer? I mean, what's the story with some of this stuff? I mean, what's your general feeling about this?
The answer is pretty much no, 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 and no. You know, people, vitamin C, for instance, it's not that, you know, these are uneducated people. I think it was Linus Pauling who, you know, towards the end of his career made huge claims about vitamin C and that, you know, its benefits and how much good it was going to do. But everybody believes in all of these doses of vitamin. You can't even go into Costco or a farm, you know, to see GNC, I mean, to see all the different vitamins you can take mega doses of. And yet, when you do the studies, and they have done studies of vitamin C, of echinacea, of zinc, you know, again and again and again, these things don't seem to work. And I'll get back to the exception, which is zinc at the end. But, you know, your body and all the evolution that you talked about before, we need a certain amount of vitamin. And if we get that amount of vitamin, we are healthy. When you take in any more, all you're doing is making your urine very expensive. Because you just excrete it. The body doesn't store it. The body doesn't know what to do with it.
These molecules don't have any other ones. What about A, D, E, and K, which are the fat-soluble ones?
Well, you know, to be honest, vitamin A is actually, in too large doses, can actually be dangerous. And it always makes me think of Airborne. Airborne, as you mentioned, was marketed as this, you know, herbal supplement, which is going to prevent colds. It was invented by a teacher. This one get a lot of press because it sat on the side of the box that it was scientifically proven to work in clinical research. And when they did some investigations, they found that was a complete and utter fraud, that the research, I think, was like two guys in a garage making up the data. And they had to pay out millions of dollars in claims. They had to remove that from the side of the box, but the original composition of Airborne had a fairly large amount of vitamin A. And taking too much of it can actually be quite dangerous. And they've actually, I think, since lowered it. My co-author likes to believe that we're responsible because of writing about Airborne in our first book. I don't know that that's true. But too much vitamin A is bad for you. And the same with some of these other vitamins. It's just that there's, you know, too much of something can be just as bad as too little. And yet we just assume because it's a vitamin that it's okay. And the stuff often doesn't, in fact, it almost always doesn't work. And sometimes it carries harm. The one exception recently, there was some press about zinc, and that zinc finally, in a big randomized controlled trial, was proven to make colds of slightly shorter duration. But if you read the fine print of that study, you had to be on the zinc for months in order to see the results. You had to be on it quite steadily. It tastes terrible, yes. And the benefit was incredibly minimal, like maybe a half day less of illness. And so it wasn't that, oh, you get sick, you take a zinc tablet. It was like commit yourself to you know, taking this thing which tastes bad, is sometimes expensive. The zinc, by the way, the zinc gel that people used to recommend in people's noses, you have a harder time finding now, killed people's sense of smell. They had to take it off the market because it actually damaged permanently people's ability to smell. These things potentially have harm. They provide almost no benefit, and when they do provide a benefit, it's almost impossible to see and impossible to achieve without some sort of lifestyle change that the vast majority of people won't want. And yet, still, there's you know, billions of dollars in business in pushing these things forward.
Two more quick questions. Have you ever heard of a website that actually I direct my patients to all the time called quackwatch.com?
No, I've not.
Okay, well, there's a website by a doctor named Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Barrett. And if you go to it, it's called quackwatch.com, and it's got a ton of stuff similar to what you're talking about and how to spot nutrition, you know, or you know, healthcare fraud, et cetera. So it might be something that, you know, you take a look at because, I mean, you know, you did such an, and Rebecca did such an amazing job in your book, but I don't know if you send it, because I send a lot of patients there when,
you know,
they're talking about.
Did he do a big piece on the Suzanne Summers book? Because I think about it, I think I might have seen that.
Yes. And he does it. I mean, the site is just, you know, just bursting at the seams with all kinds of great articles and, you know, evidence-based stuff. So it's an interesting, you know, site. But
Absolutely.
Let's go back to you. And real quick, can you talk real quickly before we get, you know, because Rachel should get some, Dr. Vreeman should get some credit here. You know,
yep.
You know, how do you guys, are you guys partners or?
Well, she was my fellow, and now she's a coworker. In fact, you would probably enjoy talking to her because her main area, of her real job, as we like to refer to our real jobs, is actually she spends at least half the year, if not more, in Kenya, where she works on pediatric adherence for HIV therapy.
Wow.
And so she's very into sort of AIDS research and HIV research and trying to prevent transmission and trying to get things to work better for kids in Africa, often because they're orphaned and there's so much else going on.
That's wonderful. So Rebecca does mainly pediatrics.
Yeah, so Rachel is also a pediatric health services researcher. And so her area of interest is pediatric adherence in HIV therapy in resource-limited settings. But so our sort of our real jobs, you know, we interact in sort of just as colleagues, but, you know, we did both of the books together, and who knows if we'll do another, but, you know, we did collaborate a lot on these and some prior work, but these days she spends at least 6 months a year on the other side of the ocean, and she's always seems to be traveling internationally and doing presenting and has built a nice career and is doing very well in that area as well.
All right, last question. So after all this is said and done, and we have, you know, debunked a lot of stuff, or you have debunked a lot of stuff, and we've talked about a lot of our own philosophies, which seem to be very much in line, as have our lives, what's your best advice if you're going to tell a patient to stay healthy?
You know, so much of it is common sense. I think it's, you know, if, you know, eating healthy, you know, taking care of yourself and exercising. You know, for preventing illness, probably nothing does as much good as good hand washing. You know, wash your hands before you eat. Wash your hands after you've touched something you think is dirty. You know, wash your hands and then wash your hands again. I think that does a lot. But otherwise, I think it's a lot of common sense things. It's take care of yourself. It's try to, you know, eat a good diet. Try to do things in moderation. And yet don't do anything crazy either. You know, it's still okay to enjoy life and enjoy yourself and to enjoy things which in moderation, even which may be unhealthy in large bulk. But I guess I tell people to relax. Like, you know, millions of years of evolution have created us to the point where we're reasonably hardy. We're not going to drop dead any second now. You know, we're not that fragile, so we don't have to be panicked at all the time about all these things killing us. And at the same time, you know, just do the simple, common sense things to take care of yourself, and you'll probably live a long time.
I think that's terrific, and what you seem to be getting at is what I get at as well, is, you know, it's much easier to prevent a disease or prevent problems than to dig people out of a hole later on.
Yes, absolutely.
And so maybe, you know, adding to what you were saying, you know, the other, you know, eating, exercising, you know, de-stressing, et cetera, but, you know, vaccines I'm a big believer in. I mean,
yep,
if we can
absolutely
prevent preventable stuff, that's
yeah,
easy. Any last words for us, or, you know, anything else that maybe we missed?
So, Leo, I'll just quickly mention my two favorites, because one of them is coming up, Thanksgiving. Turkey does not make you sleepy. Please, please, please don't buy into that one as we approach November.
Okay.
And the other one, my other all-time favorite, is that sugar does not make kids hyper. Again, as we approach Halloween and other things, there's plenty of reasons not to eat a ton of candy, but bad behavior is not one of them. There's tons of evidence that sugar has no impact on a kid's hyperactivity whatsoever.
Phenomenal. Well, Aaron, thank you so, so much. This has been terrific and really enlightening. So Dr. Aaron Carroll, author of the book Don't Cross Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way, and 75 Other Health Myths Debunked. I'm Dr. Gary Cohan. We're both Amherst alums, and thanks for listening to the interview.
Thank you.